When Lucia Chase died in 1986, the Washington Post described her as the sovereign mother of American ballet. Ms. Chase spent over 35 years as a director and dancer for the American Ballet Theater, helping make it one of the finest ballet companies in the world, and was much beloved for her performances as the Queen Mother in the ABT's Swan Lake. She took the ABT on tour to Russia during the Cold War and attracted ballet greats like Mikhail Baryshnikov and Natalia Makarova to join it in America. Her son, Alex C. Ewing, followed her into ballet management, and now he's written a biography called Bravura, Lucia Chase and the American Ballet Theater. It's published by University Press of Florida. I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show, along with Kevin McKenzie, the current artistic director of the American Ballet Theater. Welcome to our show.
Yeah. Thank you.
Alex, your mother was born in 1897, the daughter of the president of the Waterbury Clock Company in Connecticut. What were the expectations for a woman of means at that time?
Well, that was pretty unusual, that she wanted to leave Waterbury and the Junior League and any little opportunities in Waterbury and go to New York. And it was amazing she had two parents that were perfectly willing to support her ideas. As long as one of their children was responsible, they were right behind them.
So she went to college, which
she went
instead
to college,
of becoming a debutante?
But she never admitted it, going to college, because even that she felt would have classified her as something apart from dancers.
Well, how old was she when she took up classical ballet?
Well, really took it up. Seriously, it would have been in about 1935, and she was born in 97, so that makes her 38 years old.
Wow.
That is unbelievable, isn't it?
More than rare? I mean, most ballerinas are kind of thinking of retiring at that age.
It's not rare. It's unheard of. I think the thing that was unique about Lucia was that starting at such a late age, she was driven by a certain passion, but she also had, I think, a sense of what her limits were. She knew she was a great performer. She wanted to dance on point and did, but very soon she took on the mantle of a director and said, I need to have some classical ballerinas here.
But she also was better known, I think, for her acting
for
skills
her
and for her technical ability.
Exactly, yeah.
Because it would be almost impossible to have the great technique if you don't start at the age of seven?
Oh, to that degree, absolutely. But I do think that the thing that was, she had an understanding of what the classical technique needed, and you need that even to be a character actor. There's no greater sort of base for movement than ballet.
So what did she do between college and deciding? I mean, she was obviously fooling around with becoming a dancer, but what did she do in all those years before she actually made the leap into dance?
Well, dance was a little bit secondary to her. She wanted a theater career, and so she really wanted to be an actress. And she also had a good voice and was taking singing lessons. So she hadn't really set on dancing until Mortkin took her on, really. And I think she would have been very much on the type of Mary Martin if she had ever gotten that kind of an invitation.
So she would have done Broadway musical if she had born in a later time. She got married somewhere during this period.
Oh, she got married early on. Yeah. I mean, not early on in her life. She was in her 30s. But her husband and she had the most wonderful life for 6 years, and then all of a sudden he died.
But was he supporting her in ambitions?
Totally. He would. But they had a married life and had two children. I was one of them. And it was expected that that was going to be their life, and she'd do what she could on the side. And then he died.
But he left her wealthy.
He left her wealthy, yes. He also left her absolutely so stricken that she was almost, I think, almost suicidal. If it hadn't been for having two children, she might not have wanted to carry on.
And never remarried?
Never remarried.
The name Mortkin was just brought up, Mikhail Mortkin. Can you tell us a bit about him, Kevin?
Well, he was a Russian immigrant who had a ballet troupe, if you will, if not really a full-fledged company. And he was teaching and putting on productions. And at the time of Lucia's dealing with her grieving, you may have to remind me how they came to know one another. But she viewed him as a savior. He started to train her, and it was a focus to get her through the grief of losing her husband. And she discovered a new passion. It channeled everything in her talents into one place.
Well, he must have seen something in her. He called her the all-American prima ballerina.
Well, Mortkin would say what he wished, and no one would contradict him. and you would do what Mortkin wished and not contradict him. I mean, he was titanic. I think I'm probably the only person left on this planet that ever rode on Mortkin's shoulders into the waves. But he was quite a figure in the old days, because he was Pavlova's partner, and he was quite an impressive character on stage. And he did absolutely insist that Lucia pay attention to whatever he said and do whatever he said.
But I was curious about that phrase that she was all-American prima ballerina. Obviously, the dancers who were here were pretty much all imported. In fact, most of the dance companies were imported as well. What was the state of ballet in the United States in the 30s and 40s?
Oh.
There was no real professional, except
for ballet russe.
Yeah.
Ballet russe that had survived from Diaghilev and went through several stages was here.
But it was a kind of an import.
It was a touring company, but there was no American organized company. At all. There were ballet schools led by people like Morgan, who had finished their performing career and had settled around the country and started to teach and invariably put on performances, but they were not on a professional level quite yet.
And the amazing thing is that when ballet theater started in 1940, there was really no American ballet. I mean, there was the San Francisco Ballet on the other side of the country, and Catherine Littlefield in Philadelphia, I guess. But otherwise, there was nothing. And then, within the next decade or two decades, there was a professional ballet company in almost every major city.
Yeah, it spread like wildfire.
It was extraordinary what happened.
And people like Balanchine became superstars.
Yeah. Oh, he started off as one and became more of one.
What kind of reviews did your mother get? Did you see her perform?
All the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every Saturday, that was the only place she knew where to take my brother and me, to take us to the ballet and put us in a safe seat. But I saw her all the time. She was very good on stage, and she was quite funny when she had a humorous part. And so she was fun to watch, but it was not like watching Baranova.
She was an amazing presence on stage. Yeah. You know, and you know, by the time I came along, you saw her do probably more dancing roles. I saw her do all of her character roles that she did through the years that she became quite famous for. But she could be chilling, and she could be hysterically funny. Her ability to act through movement, not just through interpretation, was remarkable.
Well, you joined the ABT near the end of her tenure.
Yeah, I was her last promotion, as a matter of fact. I joined in the last year of her tenure, and just before she left, she promoted me.
Let's talk a bit about Richard Pleasant and the role that he had in developing the ballet theater with Lucia. Did the two of them just get together and say, we must do something, create a ballet theater?
Well, I don't think it was quite that way, but Richard Pleasant was an amazing man because he was trained as an architect, and then he couldn't find a job in the 30s as an architect, so he went into the film business, and he couldn't do that. And so he was just desperate for any kind of a job, and they asked him if he would run Mortkin's school, which really meant answering the telephone and keeping attendance. And from that little post, he came in contact with all the dancers that were coming through New York and all the performances, if any, that were being done. And he got this vision of starting a major American ballet company, which was just amazing for a guy from Colorado change as an architect.
Well, but also the country was just coming out of the Great Depression in 1940. It had to be risky to even consider doing something like this.
And the war was on. The war started in 39, and actually that really helped because the dancers that were in Europe were suddenly losing all their opportunities to perform, and even their countries were being invaded. So they came to America.
Lucia was dancing with the company?
Yes, during those
years. She was with Mortkin's company, mm-hmm. which was the original nucleus, but Dick Pleasant didn't like Mortkin, and he gradually winnowed most of that away, but she stayed in. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She was also, as a founder of the ABT, being asked to give it some money. Did she resent that? And did the other dancers know that?
She had a, you know, Lucia had a very peculiar way of sort of compartmentalizing those two parts of her identity. You know, the dancer in her, as Alex said, didn't want to sort of admit she'd gone to college, because if you'd been to college, you hadn't spent your time dancing. So she didn't. She wanted to be identified as the performer and the dancer. But she did support it, as Alex can well say, but she kept a very low profile about it.
My guests are Kevin McKenzie, who is the artistic director of the American Ballet Theatre, and Alex C. Ewing, who has written a book called Bravura, Lucia Chase and the American Ballet Theatre University Press of Florida. Alex, one of the most striking things I learned from your book is how financially difficult it is to run a ballet company even when it's doing great at the box office.
Well, that is true at all stages, I think, and Kevin can certainly attest to it.
There's a reason they're called not-for-profits.
It's just like, it's very much like opera. The expenses are on every side, and tickets just can't possibly cover. Even 50% would be amazing.
Well, you used to run the Joffrey, and the Joffrey was a major ballet company with a school here in New York, and it wound up having to move to Chicago because it couldn't keep itself going.
No, it couldn't pay its Social Security taxes.
Yeah,
and
it's the plight of any nonprofit.
Yeah, it's a terribly hard problem.
So what were dancers paid in the 30s and 40s?
Oh, well, ballet theater, when it started, had two smaller companies, one of black dancers and one of Spanish Americans, and they were paid $20 for a performance and $10 for a rehearsal. That's a week.
Wow.
And when dancers in general, I don't know exactly what they were paid, but it would be certainly less than $100.
Oh, yeah, in those days.
Yeah.
And even by the time I started my career in the 70s, you know, I think my first paycheck was $200 a week, and I felt rich beyond
Well, in other countries, companies are subsidized. Would that be the solution to the American problem?
It's a solution, and it's just a different problem. Because many times with government support, there's certain strings attached. Going it alone and trying to realize your vision is, you have to go out and then fight for money. They're both in perfect worlds. But certainly the government support one is a far more secure one.
The government might keep you alive, but it probably wouldn't allow you to really do something of high quality unless you raise the money yourself.
Yeah.
Well, the ABT began with a performance of Les Sylphides in 1940, and Lucia performed in it. And Kevin, didn't you dance in Les Sylphides to open the 40th anniversary gala of the American Ballet Theatre at the Met in 1980?
I did.
The same choreography?
Yeah, the exact same choreography. Okay. Yeah, and I actually have a very funny story about Lucia for this, and it sort of illuminates her sense of humor. By the time I came along, she, of course, had seen many dancers come and go, and for the first 3 months I was in the company, she called me Johnny. And I thought, maybe this woman is getting on in years. And then when I was standing there getting ready for my first performance of Les Sylphides at Kennedy Center, she came by on the stage and she looked and saw me and she went, Johnny, your first performance of Les Sylphides. And then she turned around and went, why, you're not John Meehan at all. You're John Neumeier. And then left the stage. I thought, oh, my God, what is going on? She called me Kevin thereafter. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, she had such a great sort of twinkle in her eye when half the time you didn't know if she was using that humor to get her way or if she was really off by then. But she was never. She knew exactly what was going on.
Well, maybe she thought that you danced like one of those Johnnies.
Well, I think I looked a lot like one of those Johnnies. Mm-hmm.
Now, the ABT opened with a big bang.
Oh, it was a fantastic bang.
Yeah.
I mean, even after the first night, the New York Times said this is the best move towards developing American ballet that we've had. And it has really been a season of 3 weeks. I think they did 11 new works and 3 revivals. And
The ambitiousness of it was amazing. Mind-boggling. Yeah.
Well, there was Pillar of Fire. Can you tell us about that?
Well, that's a little bit later. That was about 4 years later. But Pillar of Fire almost never saw the light of day because Hurok was running the publicity and the promotion of ballet theater, and he hated Pillar of Fire. They called it Pills of Fire, and he didn't want it. He wanted to have something that was very showy and that sent people home whistling the tunes, and he didn't want anything psychological or moving like that.
But it gave the ABT a reputation for being innovative.
Exactly, and that was partially because Lucia insisted upon it, and Tudor emerged as literally the artistic conscience of ABT. You know, he turned out to define those two words, ballet theater, from a strictly creative point of view.
Now, Tudor, of course, was also an import. How many Americans were actually involved in the American Ballet Theater at the beginning? Other than your mother.
Well, it took about a generation of Lucia's directorship to develop them.
Were you already seeing ballet schools of any consequence by this time?
Beginning, but really it was through the creative team that she put together that were, yes, imports, that then found Americans' muses. Tudor found Nora Kay as his muse, and she became the first real homebred, cradle-to-grave ballerina within an organization, if you will. And then later, people like Johnny Kreitzer and people, that really were there when the first decade's worth of real gold mines identity-making ballets were made.
And Jerome Robbins found his muse, which was himself.
Yeah.
and he really came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
He was just a dancer in the company when he did Fancy Free. It was one of the most successful first performances. They had to even repeat one of the dances in it before they would allow it to go on.
And that really did give a stamp of American to the ABT.
And Agnes DeMille's presence, it is ballet theater is not unlike the story of the country. It's a melting pot. It's that mixture of cultures that draw from all over the world, but then eventually become something in and of itself.
Did Lucia get along well with Agnes DeMille?
It was a wonderful relationship, but saying getting along well doesn't get the real color of it. They were a little bit like cats, and when they were happy with each other, they would play, and otherwise they might spit and snarl a little bit. But in the end, I would think that each one of them was the first champion of the other. And Agnes said so many things from the stage about Lucia Chase, and Lucia Chase always turned to Agnes when she wanted to have something further.
Much of the story is about touring. Companies cannot survive without touring, but touring is incredibly expensive. But touring was really important for the ABT, wasn't it?
Well, that was the only employment that could keep people together for 30 weeks or so.
How were they received, for example, in England and then later when they went to the Soviet Union?
Abroad, they were received very well.
Really well.
But in America, just to pick up on that, it was heroic and hard to understand now what these dancers did day after day in buses and in trains. They would go from city, arriving just in time for the performance, try to get their laundry done if they were there for 2 days, but they weren't usually only for 1 day. And the muscles would get cramped in the bus, and they would always have an hour or two to get something to eat. And they did this across the country, back and forth.
Year after year. But, and the flip side of that is I still have people coming to me whenever ABT tours, and this elderly gentleman or woman will come up and say, I'm so happy you're back. I used to come every year to see Alonzo and Yuskevich. Every year. And we were in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Well, the trip to the Soviet Union kind of led to Baryshnikov and Makarova coming to the ABT, didn't it?
I'm not sure that that trip did, but that was certainly by the time
they both defected, ABT had defined itself like most national companies on a par of the Royal Ballet and the Paris Opera and the Kirov and the they had that same similar base of repertoire the dancers from the Kirov who defected would have naturally been attracted to.
They also got caught up in a revolution in Argentina. Were you going along on any of these tours?
No, I wasn't doing
that. What were you and your brother doing? Staying at home?
Well,
wishing you were there?
Although my mother would never have admitted it. We were a good deal older than anyone would have suspected for the sons of a dancer, because by the time that we went to Russia, that was something like 62, and I was born in 31, so I was already in my 30s. My brother was older than I was, and she kept those secrets to herself. Nobody ever really knew how old she was. In fact, the New York Times, when she died, had a 24-hour hysterical search trying to find out exactly what was her birthday.
Didn't she have an odd relationship with the Times, especially John Martin, the ballet critic, who could be quite rude about her leadership of the ABT?
Yeah.
What bothered him?
Well, it was an aesthetic thing, and you could understand it in a way, because she was not groomed in the classics. She was not aesthetic. She was not somebody who knew all that was going on in the various arts, like the average ballet company director. Someone like Joffrey or Merce Cunningham, or they knew what was happening in Balanchine and Kirstein. My mother didn't have that, and that bothered Martin.
She didn't hang out with Robert Rauschenberg.
No.
So was she pleased when you decided to go into dance as well?
Not at all.
Really?
She didn't mind when I came into ballet theater, because she thought, well, I can come in and raise some money for them. But when I went into Joffrey, it was a real problem, because we were in competition, and I had City Center, and she didn't have a home, so that was a tough time.
But then that's when you joined Robert Joffrey and Gerald Arpino. That was the mid-60s?
Yes.
And then you became the Chancellor Emeritus of the University of North Carolina School of the Arts. Decided that running a dance company was just too difficult?
No. I had stopped doing that. I was running a land and cattle company when they asked me to do that. But I was the head of their board of visitors. They knew. But the School of the Arts is a fantastic school where all the students want to become a professional in the performing arts.
Kevin, are you listening? Or are you happy running a dance company?
Oh, no, I'm very happy running a dance company. And, you know, ABT has a school of its own also. But I think the salient point here is being able to have a life within a chosen field. One couldn't ask for more fulfillment.
When Lucia Chase died in 1986, the dance critic of the New York Times, Anna Kiselgoff, said the American Ballet Theater will always be remembered as Lucia Chase's company. Do we see reflections of that in the way the company looks today?
I think so. I like to think that the mysterious link, if you will, of my crossing paths with her, and then serendipitously ending up being the actual director years later.
You follow Baryshnikov?
Jane Herman, who was briefly director between Misha and myself, but I grew up on my aesthetic artistically was in large part defined on Lucia Chase's ballet theater, on the works of Tudors, on the works of DeMille, on the Swan Lake that she commissioned from David Blair. Those were my impressions of what defined taste, and I think that they are reflected in some of the choices I make.
Alex, why have you waited nearly 25 years to write about her life?
Well, I was very busy when I was the head of the School of the Arts, so I didn't have a chance then. And then I really started to write it because I realized that almost everybody who had known her well was dead and gone. I mean, Nora Kay was gone, DeMille was gone, Oliver Smith was gone, you name it, Johnny Creasy was gone. And I thought, someone's going to have to say this from the inside before it just becomes a sort of a historical research project. And so I felt I've got a mandate of being one of the last ones that really knew what her private life was and what her hopes and aspirations were and what her character was.
And the book, Bravura, Lucia Chase and the American Ballet Theater, just published by University Press of Florida, with wonderful pictures. Should point that out as well. My great thanks to Alex C. Ewing, the author, and to Kevin McKenzie, the artistic director of the American Ballet Theater. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Great to be here.
Pleasure for us.